Hare Krishna. Welcome to the Nectar of Instruction. We are discussing the second verse now. The first verse we'll complete and then we'll go to the second verse if possible today. The first verse we are discussing is about the six vegas. Vacho vegam, manasah krodha vegam, jivha, udaropastha vegam, etan vegan yo visheta dhira, sarvam apimam prithivim sashishyat. So we were discussing first about atonement. There is a direct method, the traditional method of cultivation of qualities for purification, and then there is the panchvacharatra method, the devotional method centered on practicing bhakti yoga. And in that we discussed about vacho, manasaha and krodha vega based on Srila Prabhupada's commentary. We'll complete that, the remaining three vegas, and then we'll look at what Srila Prabhupada says based on Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's commentary. Let's look at the PPT here. So we have Jivha and Udaropastha Vega. So in Jivha Vega, the urge of the tongue. Now this is to eat. Vacho Vegam refers to the urge of the tongue to speak. Now Jivha Vegam, Srila Prabhupada says that actually people are controlled by their tongue and they are running here and there because of that. So people are forced to eat in non-devotee shops, even devotees. And a solution is prasad. And then the solution has two parts: be grateful when Krishna supplies, accept as mercy, and take at scheduled times. Let's look at this a little bit more in detail. Now today, many people are committing suicide with their tongue. The way they are eating, they are inviting death. Not just in terms of the kinds of food that they eat, that is definitely there, but also the quantities of food that they eat. As an old Egyptian proverb which says that you live on 1/3 of what you eat, on the remaining 2/3 lives your physician. So this is all the more true in today's society, where obesity is fast becoming one of the most widespread causes of avoidable disease, and not just disease but even death. So this of course is a combination of Jivha and Udara Vega. Srila Prabhupada doesn't talk too much about Udara Vega. The two are connected. So what is the essential difference? Jivha Vega refers to the taste. No, we want to eat a lot of variety of objects which are all delicious. And Udara Vega refers to the quantity. We want to eat more than what our body needs. So of course, when the desire to eat a variety of foodstuffs, then that Jivha Vega will lead to the Udara Vega also. So the point is not to have a hair-splitting analysis between the two. The point is to understand the underlying common principle of controlling the urge of the tongue. Now, Jivha Vega today is especially difficult to control in today's culture, because in the past food was primarily given as charity, and even when food was sold as a commodity, it was never marketed as aggressively as it was today. Although people throughout history have eaten delicious foods according to their cultures, according to their social situations, but the sheer amount of marketing that happens today is historically unprecedented. And because of that, people are caught in a cultural bind actually. The cultural bind is because our society often looks down at people who are obese. People who are fat, the whole society's mood, idea is to look good, to look smart. And generally smart looks are equated with thin looks. So a person who is obese is almost treated like a paria, is like a untouchable or a visually untouchable, unseeable person. Such a person, actually, people just to try to avoid looking fat, do all sorts of things. They do bariatric surgeries. They often undergo anorexia. They don't eat food properly. So on one side, people have uncontrolled tongues, which are further fueled by the external propaganda, which makes them want to eat more and more and more. And on the other side, there is the cultural glamorization of the thin figure, which prevents people from eating. And both ways, people want both. Want to have a thin, good-looking figure, and they also want to have enjoy the tongue's delights, which the tongue is also pulling them. And externally also the culture is glamorizing various foods. So it's a torturous situation. And generally it's damned if you do it, damned if you don't do it. So damned if we don't eat, because the mind will keep torturing, the senses, tongue will keep torturing. If we do it, then we become more overweight and we face problems because of that. So either way, the point is that we have to rise to a higher level of consciousness. Just trying to control the senses at the same material level of consciousness is nearly impossible. It's like playing a game that we can't win and can't quit. Imagine there's a huge boxer fighting with a thin, skinny person who neither has strength nor has skill to fight. And the person that people are in the same ring. So this poor fellow will just get beaten again and again and again. And if there's a rule that is no matter how badly this fellow gets beaten, not allowed to quit the ring. So what happens? Can't win. There's just no chance of winning. But can't quit. So just get beaten, 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 beaten. That's the predicament at the material level of consciousness. On one level, we are faced with so many desires, and most material desires, they have these two characteristics. They are insatiable and they are irresistible. Irresistible means we just can't say no to them. At least at the material level of consciousness, it's almost impossible to say no to them. Because we are living for material enjoyment only. So they are irresistible. And then they are insatiable. That means if I try to satisfy them, they don't get satisfied. They blaze further and become bigger. And then I become trapped further. So this is the two-way bind, insatiability and irresistibility. Insatiability means we can't win the game. Irresistibility means we can't quit the game. So we can't win the game means even if we satisfy those desires, even if we get those enjoyments, we don't win because those desires blaze further and they want us to get more and more and more. So it's insatiable. And irresistible means if you say, I'll just not bother about this desire. It doesn't work. Because the desires keep haunting us, goading us, biting us from inside. Do this, get this, enjoy this. So that is the sorry predicament that we find ourselves in. And this is not just the predicament for devotees. Earlier I talked about wanting to eat and enjoy and wanting to have a good figure and enjoy. That is a predicament which even non-devotees, even general people face this. And also, beyond that, there is also the whole point that even materialistic people cannot fulfill all the desires that are there in their mind. How can they? Because their bodies are limited, their resources are limited, their lifespan is limited. They can't fulfill all the desires. So they also have to live with unfulfilled desires, and that also causes anguish to them. So the torture is there for everyone at the material level of consciousness. No matter what happens, everybody has to struggle and suffer. Now, when we talk about controlling the tongue, what does it mean? There is one level of control that is for looking good. Now, some people fast. There are diets for reducing one's weight are very popular. And there are all kinds of sometimes crazy diets. Sometimes there's one particular diet which has become popular because of the advocacy of one particular set of doctors. Although other doctors are militantly opposed to it. They say that just gorge on one day and fast on the next day. That means one day, eat whatever you like. Whatever you like. Just fulfill all your heart's desire. And the next day, just take some soup, take some salad, eat nothing, practically speaking. And they say, overall, the body is, if you gorge on one day and fast on the next day, then overall the body's balance will such that actually you will lose weight. Now, first of all, it's very unlikely that the body will lose weight. But even if that happens, that doesn't suit the body's biochemical mechanism. The body just doesn't know what is going to happen, how I'm supposed to adapt. The body has its own clock and its own system. It's very physically as well as psychologically hazardous. So people are desperate to at one side satisfy the tongue and at the same time not pay the cost for satisfying the tongue. And because of that, they are in a trap. So fasting is often adopted by people as a means to decrease their weight. And some people maybe seem to be very controlled in their tongue, very selective in their eating. Now, to the extent a person has self-control, that is appreciable. But just self-control in and of itself is not necessarily a sign of spiritual advancement. Now, Hiranyakashipu had self-control, but he was spiritually most regressed, not at all advanced. His whole motive was not at all devotional, it was entirely anti-devotional, to defile Lord Vishnu, disrupt the order of Lord Vishnu, and eventually provoke and destroy Lord Vishnu. So, just the ability to control the tongue in and of itself is not necessarily spiritual. Although it is valuable, you could say even essential, for making steady spiritual advancement. But we shouldn't glorify it as a separate virtue. But the whole process of devotional service is such that as we go along the expressway of devotional service, the senses automatically get regulated. So when we take prasad, at that time, we learn to control the tongue, because prasad itself circumscribes, it limits the kinds of food that we will get. So that itself is a major level of sense control, because there are so many allurements over the tongue, and if you decide I'm going to take prasad, then that limits the varieties available for our tongue to titillate itself. Of course, once we get adapted to those limitations, within those limitations, prasad also offers us nearly endless allurements. And as sadhakas, we also need enjoyment. We need enjoyment even at the material level, and that is not banned. Bhakti provides us material enjoyment that is within the precincts of dharma. So taking prasadam, feasting on prasadam, is not necessarily against the principles of devotion. But making a habit of that and become attached to that and becoming emotionally dependent on opulent prasadam, sumptuous prasadam on a regular basis, can be a serious problem. Why serious problem? Because, although Krishna prasad is also Krishna, the question is not whether it is Krishna or not, the question is whether it reminds us of Krishna or not. So if we are not remembering Krishna when we are eating Krishna prasad, we are just remembering it as food, as delicious food, then of course at a subconscious level, because it has been offered to Krishna, it will purify us. But at a conscious level, we will not be remembering Krishna. And at a physical level, because of overeating, inappropriate eating, there will be physical consequences. For the manifestations of Krishna, when they come in this world, they act at a transcendental level to purify us. But at a material level, they act like other material substances. So the deity needs to be clean. The deity, if a fly is there, the deity fly has to be moved away. The deity is transcendental. But at the same time, the transcendence is not in some miraculous potency to do something which is not done normally. But the miraculous potency is the purification of the heart. So prasadam will purify our heart. At the same time, while it will purify us, a lot of the purification will depend on our consciousness. Our consciousness, if it is just seeing prasad materially, then there will be inevitably the material consequences of the way we eat prasad and the way it gels or doesn't gel with our body. But along with that, depending on our remembrance of Krishna, the purification will be maximum or minimum. So Srila Prabhupada talks in the purport about how we have to be careful about what we eat, how we eat. If you're not careful, then we can get entangled. So now generally, prasad is a temptation that is entirely within the precincts of devotional service. And we see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu feast with his devotees. And then he would often invite the devotees to eat more and more. So as the culture of prasadam. So that is wonderful. And we can take prasad. At the same time, overall, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also said, as Srila Prabhupada quotes in the purport, Bhalana Kaive or Bhalana Perime. That don't eat opulently, don't dress opulently. So on a habitual basis, having opulent prasadam is undesirable. In feasts, on special occasions, having opulent prasadam is okay. There also, the more we see prasad as Krishna's mercy, that to that extent we'll become purified. Now, Srila Prabhupada in Tapsa would also talk about fasting. He would talk about fasting on Ekadashi and fasting on Janmashtami and other festivals. So why is this fasting important? Fasting is not just something which is meant to torture the body. Kulashekhar Maharaj says in his Mukundamala Stotra that Medas Cheda Falahan Avgahanani. He says, if a person fasts, then the purpose of fasting, if one is not remembering Krishna while fasting, then medas cheda phalani. So what he says is that fasting is simply a fat reducing exercise. It doesn't lead to much spiritual benefit if you're not remembering Krishna. If we are remembering Krishna, then fasting provides us an opportunity to sacrifice the good for the best. What does it mean? Sacrifice the good for the best. See, there is the bad, there is the good, and there is the best. The bad is pap, the good is punya, but the best is bhakti. Best is Krishna. So prasad, of course, is not punya. Prasad is a part of bhakti only. But still, as I said, prasad has a material aspect to it also, which can distract us from Krishna consciousness. So normally, when we practice spiritual life, we give up sinful activities. We sacrifice the bad for the sake of Krishna. But along with that, sometimes the good can also attract us and distract us from remembrance of Krishna. So that's why sacrificing the good for the sake of the best is also a way to show our single-pointed focus on Krishna. So often our desires get splayed over a variety of things. Bahushakha hi anantascha buddhayo avyavasayinam. In 2.41 in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says that bahushakha, many branches are there for our desires. And then to emphasize it, anantascha. He says there are not just bahu many, but there are ananta, innumerable. So our power to desire gets played over many objects in this world. And that's why the strength of our desire for Krishna is not very high. So when we fast, what is the purpose of that fasting? You know, our desires that have been dissipated over various things, you know, we just bring all those desires, concentrate them on Krishna. So much, O Krishna, do I desire you. More than food, more than water, more than sleep. I can't do that throughout my life, but I can do it at least on special days. So for us, fasting is a way of showing Krishna the intensity of our longing for Him. So if we are fasting and thinking of food, then we will not make much spiritual advancement. In fact, we will torture ourselves by fasting. Or if we are able to fast, then we will become proud of that fasting. Now, if we are fasting and then looking at who all is eating what and thinking, these people have no control over this, and so just see how much they are eating. Then our body is fasting, but our ego is feasting. And that will not lead to any spiritual advancement, practically speaking. But even if that doesn't happen, so our fasting should not be our ego's feet. It should be our devotion's fruit. Not our ego's feet means, yes, I can do this. Based on that, if we fast, then there's not much spiritual advancement. But devotion's fruit means that when we try to fast, our primary focus is that we don't want to distract our time and most importantly our thoughts, our desires, away from Krishna to anything else at that time. So the purpose of fasting is to concentrate our desires primarily and possibly exclusively on Krishna, at least during the duration of the fast. So when the hunger starts tormenting us, at that time, if we turn our thoughts towards Krishna and fix the thoughts on Krishna, then the remembrance of Krishna gives us a non-material nourishment that helps us to transcend the torment of hunger. That's what Parikshit Maharaj tells Shukadeva Goswami. I don't think that I am troubled by hunger. Why? Because I am drinking the nectar of Krishna Katha from your ears. So when we are remembering Krishna, then that gives us a non-material nourishment that minimizes the torment created by the lack of physical nourishment. And in this way, we experience the reality of the higher happiness of Krishna consciousness. See, the higher happiness of Krishna consciousness depends on the focus of our consciousness in Krishna. If we are not conscious of Krishna, we cannot experience the happiness of Krishna consciousness. So fasting forces us to become conscious of Krishna. Because if we are not conscious of Krishna, then immediately we become conscious of the hungry stomach. And then that starts tormenting us. So that's why fasting is not just a physical austerity. It can be a devotional austerity. It can be an intensification of our devotional advancement, of devotional consciousness, if it is done properly. So the occasion, say like Ekadashi, which is normally there, you know, as devotees, we can try as much as possible to utilize the opportunity for fasting on Ekadashi. Different devotees fast at different levels. Some devotees fast nirjal. Now, nirjal fasting is difficult for many devotees, and often it is also not so good for health, even according to Ayurvedic doctors, because just the body's whole cycling system stops because there's no fluid in it. So fasting with water is also actually recommended for its health benefits also, because it allows the body to cleanse itself. When the body is not forced to take in new food constantly and digest it and process it, then the body gets time to recover, recoup and do some pending work. Just like a machine needs rest so that it can function better. Similarly, the body needs rest. Digestive mechanism, the metabolic mechanism of the body, if it gets rest from continuous inflow of new food to digest and process, then it can work to cleanse itself internally and heal itself internally. So fasting has a lot of medical benefits also. In Ayurveda, they say langhanam param aushadham, that fasting is among the best of medicines. So the water fasting or fluid fasting, taking some juices, lemon water or fruit, that's one level. So nirjal fasting is one level. One level next to that is water fasting. Then one level next to that is some juice fasting. Then below that is just fruit fasting. Below that is taking raw foods, fruits, vegetables like that. And otherwise, below that is taking no grains, but only once a day, or taking twice a day. Then taking thrice a day. Now many devotees actually on Ekadashi, they just consider that the only fasting is that I will not take grains on that day. Now we are missing out on the potential benefits that we can get from Ekadashi by considering Ekadashi to be just a day when we restrict the choice of the diet and not restrict the quantity and the frequency of the diet. So Ekadashi can help us to go deeper into our Krishna consciousness. Of course, we can say that more important than fasting is chanting extra and remembering Krishna extra. Yes, but the physical restriction decreases the distraction by which we are able to focus the mind on Krishna. Now, of course, if we find ourselves physically unsuited for fasting, then it's not necessary to fast. The important point is to practice devotional service. If somebody says, I'll fast but I'll sleep all day, then it's better to stay awake, remember Krishna, serve Krishna and take food whatever is required. So fasting should not become another god for us. That means another object of thought. Our fasting should be a means by which our thoughts get redirected from food to Krishna. But this jiva vegam can be controlled very powerfully by fasting. On the occasions which the scriptures anyway give us as sacred. So Srila Prabhupada writes that when we eat food also, then if we are selective, this food is delicious, I want to take that, then we are, again, not seeing things spiritually. So, if we go to a person's place because that person is going to give very nice food, then nice prasad, then we are actually succumbing to jiva vega. Now, it's not that we have to deliberately take food that is tasteless to counter the jiva vega. That is not our process. Our process is that whatever Krishna offers, we accept it. So if on some days wonderful prasadam is there, we'll take it. On some other days simple prasadam is there, we'll accept that also. So whenever there are feasts having opulent prasadam, it's fine. But we can't have feasts every day, or we can't be looking for feasts every day. Now, Then second point is with respect to controlling jiva vega is, so one is the regulation of the quantity and the variety, and then the other is the regulation of the frequency. So jiva vega is, everything is three controls. Variety of food that we take, it should be too opulent. Quantity should be regulated depending on how much is suited for our body. Generally speaking, there is hunger and there is pseudo hunger. So hunger means that the stomach is empty and the stomach needs food to continue its metabolical functions of the body. But pseudo hunger is if somebody says, I am hungry for gulab jamun. Hunger, real genuine hunger, is never specific. It is generic. Specific hunger is always pseudo hunger. So generic hunger means when the body needs things for its metabolism, then that means it needs some input by which its functioning will go on. So what the input is not particularly important from the body's metabolical point of view. It just needs fuel for running on. And of course, it has to, the what is put in has to be nourishing. But the point is that it is generic. You know, whether it is chapatis, or whether it is bhakris, or whether it is parathas, or whether it is bread, cooked by devotees, that doesn't matter so much. What matters is that it should be nourishing enough for the body. But when there is pseudo hunger, that means there is, I want this particular item itself. Now, it's not wrong to want a particular item. If it can be offered to Krishna and taken, that's fine. But we have to know what is the body's actual need and what is the mind's need. It's not that we have to reject all the mind's needs, but at least we should know. Okay, this is the mind's need, and then I can decide whether I'm going to fulfill the mind's need or not. The body's need has to be fulfilled. So whenever the hunger becomes specific, not generic, that's a safe way to understand that's not hunger, that's pseudo-hunger. So pseudo-hunger is what causes fat. Genuine hunger doesn't cause fat. Genuine hunger doesn't even actually bring our consciousness down to rajoguna or tamoguna. When we overeat, then we want to oversleep. Either we want to oversleep, or because of overeating, then people get into passion and they want to enjoy. So it, generally, whenever we eat too much variety, too much quantity, then that sort of eating can drag our consciousness down to passion or ignorance. So satisfying hunger doesn't lead to any such problems. It's only pseudo-hunger that causes these problems. So with respect to, after considering controlling the quantity, the variety, then let us look at the frequency. Now frequency means that how often should we take prasad? There is the pastime of Sarvabhum Bhattacharya and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in the Chaitanya Charitamrit. After Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Sarvabhum Bhattacharya had this momentous conversation in the temple of Jagannath, Puri, temple of Jagannath. And then Sarvabhum Bhattacharya was converted. The next morning Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to meet Sarvabhum Bhattacharya and gave him prasad, brought some prasad for him. So Sarvabhum Bhattacharya had woken up late and he just came out, he saw Chaitanya Mahaprabhu offered obeisances. And then he got up and he said, I'm so fortunate that I am able to see you. And then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave him prasad and he immediately took the prasad and honored it. So then he said, what is this Sarvabhama? He says, you are a Brahmana, you have not yet taken bath, you have not done your Sandhya Vandan. How can you eat food like this? And then Sarvabhum Bhattacharya said, he quoted a verse from the Purana saying that Prapti Matrena Bhoktavyam. He says, as soon as prasad is obtained, immediately you should eat it. Prapti Matrena Bhoktavyam. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu became so happy. He said, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu felt as if the purpose of his descent from the spiritual world had been fulfilled. That as if he had conquered the whole universe. Now, what was Chaitanya Mahaprabhu so ecstatic about? That eat prasad as soon as you get it. That is not the main lesson of this pastime. The main lesson of this pastime is the transformation of the heart of Chaitanya, of Sarvabhum Bhattacharya, and his development of faith in the principle of mercy. He was earlier a dry logician, he was an impersonalist, and his he was not focused so much on bhakti, although he was worshipping Jagannath. The idea was that ultimately one has to use jnana. And those who are of this category, they think that what brings advancement is the rigid adherence to the rules, not so much the principle of mercy. So what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu saw in this pastime is that Sarvabhum Bhattacharya's faith in the principle of mercy has become far greater than his faith in the rigid adherence of rules. So it was that which made Chaitanya Mahaprabhu elated. So when the deity prasadam comes and one sees the prasadam as mercy, and then one doesn't bother about one's rules and takes the deity prasadam. So that is what it is, the increased faith in the principle of mercy as compared to the principle of rigid adherence of rules. That is what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appreciated. Now in our case, what happens is we are really not thinking of prasadam as mercy. We think of prasadam as opportunity to enjoy. So if some other devotees are, we shouldn't, if somebody takes prasadam just whenever it comes, we shouldn't think what the, we shouldn't try to figure out what the consciousness of that person is. And that devotee can take that. But for ourselves, we are not here to judge others. But we do want to make sure that our consciousness stays spiritual. So if somebody gets prasadam at other times, then we may decide we can take a little bit, honor it if we want. Or we can offer obeisances to it. That is also another way of honoring it. That's what Haridas Thakur did in his last days when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu brought prasad to him. Or we can keep it and take it later during prasadam times. It's best that we keep our prasadam times regulated. That means take prasad at fixed times. So that will also ensure that we are not food conscious, we are Krishna conscious. We are always thinking, where will I get good food? Where will I get food? Good food. So this is Jivha Vegam. Now, let's move forward to, we also discuss Udara Vegam in this also. Now, when it is said that we should, Prabhupada will often quote Ayurveda and say that 50% of our stomach can be filled with food, 25% can be kept for air, and 25% for water. So the idea is, how do I know what is 50%? So Krishna gives a broad guideline. Nati ashnatastu yogosti na chaikandam anashnataha. He says, one should not eat too much, and one should not eat too little. So how do we know what is too much and too little? We don't know for ourselves, right, as a rigid formula. But over a period of time, we learn from ourselves. Sometimes we eat a little less, and we find that we are feeling too hungry afterwards. Sometimes we eat too much and we feel sleepy. Then by that we understand that this is how much I should be eating. So it's something we learn by experience. And our diet's quantity may also change as we grow. Because then our physical engagement may change. The level of energy that we have, the level of digestive capacity that we have, it will change. So one important point is that this regulation doesn't have to be rigid. It can be dynamic. That means depending on the nature of the service that we are doing. Suppose somebody may be fasting normal times, but if there is a service, if one is in yatra and there is a lot of physical movement to be done, a lot of physical service to be done, then at that time fasting will unnecessarily restrict our capacity to do service. Then better not fast at that time. Similarly, if we are having more service physically, then we may eat more. So Udara Vega is not necessarily the point of just sticking to a fixed quantity in eating. It is eating whatever is required for our bodily nourishment. And depending on the kind of engagement we have, that will may vary. And now, Upastha Vega. So, now the Vedic scriptures do not reject sex. Sex is an important part of life. It is the way new life comes into the world. So it is actually Krishna says, Dharma Viruddha Bhuteshu Kamosmi Bharatarshava. That I am sex life, that is not contrary to religious principles. So sometimes the whole idea that even within marriage sex life should be restricted, that may seem too much of an intrusion into one's private life and may seem to be too restrictive. Actually, the point here is not to restrict. The point is to have a balance in one's perspective. Now, to the extent, actually paradoxically, our culture glamorizes sex more and more. And as it glamorizes it, it devalues it also. Or how does it devalue it? The more we glamorize sex based on, you know, the physical form, good-looking form that are shown everywhere, to that extent, people are constantly in a state of artificial sexual stimulation, constant agitation. And then sex becomes just an activity for physical release. Just an activity for gaining physical release. There is no really intimacy between the two people. That is what happens when it is done as a professional activity in prostitution. There is just a physical release. So actually, sex is considered so sacred, it is so valued, that it is reserved for procreation. It is not that it is considered to be something so sinful, something so bad, something so negative, that it should not be done. That is not the point. When something brings new life into the world, it's not to be considered wrong. But the point is, when that which has the potential to bring new life into the world, that which is so glorious, we make it so trivial that it is just a casual activity for gaining some relief from boredom, for just gaining some physical release. Then we are trivializing that which is special. So the point here is that sex offers offers human beings the opportunity to become co-creators with God. You know, God is creating new life and He's using a male and a female to do that. So what is actually a sacred activity, we make the culture around us today, it by its incessant glamorization of that activity, trivializes it. And when it trivializes it, then it becomes just an activity for physical release. And then it further becomes, it can become even more unregulated. As I said, it can go into the means where people forcibly violate others and commit all sorts of sexual crimes. So the focus is on maintaining the spiritual vision and doing things for the purpose for which they are meant. So that way one can control the past. So the point here is not to deprive, the point is to retrieve. What does it mean? It's not that the focus is no. It's not on deprivation, it's a retrieve. Retrieve means that this particular activity has a purpose and we want to retrieve that purpose within our own understanding and act according to that purpose. Now, let's look at Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur's commentary. We have discussed most of these points already, so we'll just discuss them briefly now. So, Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur has written a commentary called the Anuvritti, and in which he described that the Vachovega. So basically, he talks about Vachovega, and he says, there's a Prajalba of the Karmis, Gyanis and Karmakandis. So all the newspapers that are there, all the magazines that are there, all the channels that are there, that talk about so many things. This is all leading to Prajalba. It is all based on mundane talk. So now, it is not that devotees have to be completely oblivious of worldly things. But often, the worldly news is not really new. One social commentator has said, all the news is old things happening to new people. All the news is old things happening to new people. There was some disaster over there. Then that was 1 year ago. Now there's some disaster here. And there's some disaster there. Okay, there was this tournament. And this team win the tournament. And now that team won the tournament. Now that team won the tournament. So it's just old things happening to new people. So it is not that devotees have to stay uninformed about material things. But we don't have to think that being informed about every single thing that is happening, that anyone considers important, that is all important. Now, we should be aware of basic things, but beyond that, we focus on being aware of our own true self. You know, being aware of ourselves as souls and our real life with Krishna. And for that, we need to study scripture, associate with devotees, and tune our consciousness spiritually. So, for our functional purposes in the world, whatever basic awareness that is required, that is fine. But just getting involved in endless talks over socio-political issues and cultural issues, if that is not leading to any Krishna-conscious inferences, conclusions, then that can be a waste of time. Actually, never before in human history has information being so totally diverse from function. Information being diverse from function. In the past, people's information was based on their function. So what does if a person is an artist, if artisans say, if a person is a potter, Then what does the person learn? The person learns pottery. So the information is connected with the function. The potter doesn't need to know everything about everything. But today, we have so much information that serves no function. This happened in this part of the world, that happened in that part of the world. You know, in this year, this war had taken place at that time. And in that year, that had happened. And this is, if we are giving some competitive exams in which this is the standard of knowledge that is required, we can study it. But in general, the point here is not to suppress our curiosity. We all have curiosity because being conscious is the nature of the Atma. It's Chit. But we can direct our curiosity radar towards Krishna instead of letting the curiosity radar go on towards material things, because they are endless and they are ultimately useless. Why useless? Because how is that information going to serve any function in our lives? Now, because we have so much information that serves no function, so we create a function for them. What is that? We create functions in terms of, there are quizzes which are based on trivias. Okay, how many daughters does this film star have? Oh, this politician, how many wives did he marry? This is trivia. But then there are quizzes, and sometimes people earn lakhs of rupees by winning quizzes where the questions are essentially trivia. So this is not really required. Again, the point is not to condemn general knowledge or to say that we have to be unaware of things. But the point is, we have to connect information with function. Otherwise, we will just go on an endless information gathering spree, which will not really lead to any functional utility. So, the solution is Harikatha. And what happens when we have this information-seeking mentality, when we come to scripture also, then we are constantly looking for information only. It's scriptural information is meant to serve transformational function. That means, when we hear something, we apply it, and we become better human beings, we become better devotees. The scriptural information is like a doctor's prescription. A doctor's prescription is not just for information value, it is for transformation value. It is meant to cure us. But if we are habituated to information diverse from function, then even when we get scriptural information, yeah, very good class. At the end of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna did not tell Arjuna, very good class, Krishna. What did Krishna tell Arjuna? Karishye vachanam tava. I'll do what you say. And he did it. So, information has to be connected with function. So, when we hear Harikatha, we shouldn't just be looking for new information. Although new information is definitely valuable. But we are looking for transformation. So, the information, whatever function it has, when we use it for that function, then the transformation results. Now, with respect to Manasaha Vega, Tathagata Thakur says that the mind's urges can be classified into two. Avirodha Priti and Virodha Yukta Krodha. So Avirodha Priti. Priti means attachment. Avirodha means unrestricted, unregulated attachment. And Virodha Yukta Krodha. So Avirodha Priti means when one is attached, one doesn't accept any rules and regulations. No stopping. I want to enjoy the way I want to enjoy, the time I want to enjoy, the quantity I want to enjoy. That's what it is. Avirodha Priti. And when there are obstacles, and so even if we don't accept any religious, scriptural regulations, still there will be practical restrictions that will come. And when those restrictions come, when our desires are not fulfilled, then virodha yukta krodha, then we get angry. So he brings vacho vegam manasaha krodha vegam. So he makes krodha as also one of the vegas of the mind. Now the point here is, again, the point of analysis is never to split our hair. Split our hair means try to find out minute differences in categories. That's never the point. Whenever the scriptures give us typology means classification into various types, the purpose is to gain a framework for our thinking and living. So whenever any class system of classification is there, it will never map accurately into reality, because reality is complex. So the system of classification is meant to act as a guideline for thinking and living. It is not meant to be like a precise point by point correlation with everything in reality. That's not the purpose. So whether anger is classified as separate vega or is it classified as a subcategory of mind, that doesn't matter. But there is, so generally whenever there is anger, we can look back at what was it that caused it, we'll find it some frustration. And when we find out, okay, it was due to frustration, then we can look back and see what was the expectation that caused the frustration. And whether the expectation was realistic, whether the expectation was desirable, whether it was necessary. So by that, by recognizing that anger comes by frustration, frustration comes by expectation, we can go to the root and check whether that expectation was warranted or not. And many times, our expectation itself of others, of things, is unwarranted. And that's what causes frustration. That's what causes eventually anger. So when there's avirodha priti, that means there's unrestricted attachment, then the expectation is too high. And then when there's frustration, actually anger comes up. So the way to curb anger is not just to not get angry, but it's also to decrease our expectations. To know that this world is a place of misery, things will go wrong over here. Therefore, if we have too many high expectations, we are just preparing ourselves for frustration and suffering. Now, after this, let's look at the Jivha Udara Pasthavegam. Now, in Jivha Vegam, now this is the point that our acharyas make, that the Jivha, Udara and Pastha are in a straight line. So we wonder, what is the physical linearity of all three got to do with anything? Our desires are something which are in the mind. So what have they got to do with the position of the three in one line? But the point is, the three in one line indicate that there is a physical connection between the two. And our desires are not entirely mental. They are connected with the physical body, and physical stimuli can increase them, and physical expressions come out when those desires become strong. So there is the spiritual level, there is the mental level, the physical level. And the physical affects the mental affects the physical. So if I lie down on an easy chair with my head resting against a comfortable headrest and then try to study, you know, my physical posture will make me more susceptible to sleep. And I'll feel, oh, the desire to sleep, if it is there, it will become stronger. If the desire to sleep is not there, still the desire to sleep may also come. So the physical is connected with the mental. So the tongue is, when we eat a lot, then the stomach becomes bloated. When the stomach becomes bloated, then actually there's the passion in the body increases. And the passion increases, then one wants to express itself. That has to be expressed in various ways. So sex, illicit sex is also one way. Now, there are various kinds of urges of the tongue. Among the various urges of the tongue, actually speaking, the urges for delicious food based on the various rasas, there are six different rasas which can be stimulated. And when those rasas are stimulated, that causes agitation of the tongue. So when we control that agitation, then we are not succumbing to the Jivha Vega. So here, the song by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, which Srila Prabhupada has given us as the Prasadam prayers, Sharira Vidya Jala comes. Actually, this song has two parts. The first is a verse from the Mahabharata. Mahaprasade Govinde Nama Brahmani Vaishnave Svalpa Punyavritam Rajan Vishwaso Neva Jayate. So it's a prayer of lamentation, saying that, alas, we don't have faith in the three manifestations of mercy. Mahaprasad, the Nama Brahmani and Vaishnave, the holy name, the Prasad and the devotees. These are actually three ways in which, three things in which we don't have faith, but the three things that we do, our faith can increase. So, first it's a prayer of lamentation, and then there is a meditation on how Prasad is so glorious. So now we see this prayer itself reveals the depth of the philosophical contemplation of the Vaishnava Acharyas. In many world religions, there is a tradition of saying grace, means to thank God for the food that has been given. That is a good tradition. But the Acharyas are thanking God not just for food that is given. Food is needed for survival. Without food, we will die. So naturally, when food is given, it's a valuable gift. It's an essential gift, and we are grateful to God for that. But the acharyas, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is not thanking God, oh God, if you didn't give me food, I will die. So thank you for giving me food. Actually, at that level, nature is providing food to everyone. Of course, it is important for humans to be conscious that the food is coming from God. Animals can't be conscious of that. But the point is that nature provides food to everyone. So bodily maintenance is arranged for by nature. So just thanking God for bodily maintenance is basically thanking God for being able to live at the animal level. We need God's grace to even live at the animal level. But thanking God to live at the animal level, to fulfill the animal needs of the body, that doesn't indicate a very high consciousness. So the whole prayer of Bhaktivinoda Thakur is focused on how Krishna has manifested through the food, as the food, as prasad, so that we can learn to control our senses and become liberated from material existence by engaging in devotional service. So the whole first part of the prayer is a meditation on how we are trapped in material existence. Sharira avidya jal jadendriyata hai kal. So the body is not just avidya, it's not just puts us in ignorance, but it puts us in a trap of ignorance, avidya jal. And further, the senses drag us further into ignorance. They drag us towards death. They drag us towards activity that will perpetuate our karmic bondage and cause us to go on in the cycle of birth and death again and again. Jadindriyata hai kal. And jive phele vishaya sagare. That there's not just one or two sense objects, there are an ocean of sense objects all around us. So we are in a really tough situation. We don't know about higher knowledge or higher taste. The body has covered that up for us. Then the senses are dragging us towards sense objects, and they are terrible. There are almost infinite number of sense objects around us. And on top of that, tar madhye jivvati lobhamo yasudurmati. And among all the senses, the tongue is the most voracious. Actually, those who learn to control the tongue find that the other senses also come under control without much difficulty. There is, of course, always a challenge to control in the sense. But the tongue, when we feel its enjoying mentality, then that enjoying mentality spreads to the rest of the body also. And other senses also become aroused with the enjoying mentality. So, in this way, when we control the senses, then we can begin control of senses by controlling the tongue. So, this whole prayer is Samsare. Because of this uncontrolled senses, we are in very great difficulty in the samsara. But seeing us suffering, struggling, sinking in the samsara, Krishna bada dama kori bare jiv bhajaye. He comes to enable us to conquer us. And how does he do that? Swaprasadanna dilobhai. So he gives us his prasad, and we are meant to take it to our heart's content, not to our tongue's content, because the tongue will never become contented. The tongue will always stay discontented and keep us discontented. So say Annamrit Pav Radha Krishna Guna Pav, that take the food which is actually amrit, which is nectar. And after taking it, what do? We want to get energy so that we can engage in devotional service. Radha Krishna Guna Gao. And then Premedako Chaitanya Nithai. So when we call out to the mercy of Gauranga Nityananda, please help us, we are struggling. It is by your mercy that we can engage in devotional service. So we want to serve Radha Krishna, and we need the mercy of Gauranga Nithai for that. So it's a profound meditation on our miserable, vulnerable, perishable condition in material existence, and the rescuing grace that Krishna manifests through food as prasad. So now after that, Srila Prabhupada goes to the belly, and there he talks about stomach diseases. We talked about how most of the sufferings come because of the overeating. So obesity is a cause of avoidable disease and death, a major cause. Now there foods can also be of various types. We'll discuss about foods in the various modes when we go into the discussion in the 17th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. But here, there's a list of various foods which can be of various kinds. So we see the person eats, there are people who are tamasic, they eat corpses. So meat eating is tamasic. Then eating food that is too spicy is rajasic. Then eating milk and grains, that is sattvic. Then taking intoxicants is also tamasic. Then beyond all this is offering food to Krishna and taking it. That is delicious. But if somebody goes to some rich person's house, some mansion, just for visiting food, then we are not really in devotional consciousness over there. So prasad is transcendental, but our consciousness is passionate at that time. So now, sometimes devotees wonder, should we differentiate between prasad? You know, is this prasad passionate? Is this rajasic? Is this tamasic? Is this sattvic? Should we look at prasad that way or not? Prasad is transcendental, no doubt, because it's offered to Krishna. So at the same time, we also have to understand that we are not transcendental, and a certain effect will be there on us of the prasad. So we have to check what is the effect that I want and what is the effect that is coming on me. So we look at it from two perspectives. Say, for example, many people who are familiar with Vedic culture, because they say Hindus, they are Indians born in India, when they come to a temple, ISKCON temple, and they hear, oh, there is pizza prasad, they get a culture shock. Because they think, how can pizza be prasad? Their idea of prasad is, you go to a temple and then you stretch forward your hand reverentially, make the palm folded, and then you get some charanamrut, get some sweet, get some sugar, and some, that's what they consider as prasad. So prasad, for them, you know, for them pizza is a Western delicacy. How can pizza be prasad? They get a sort of culture shock by that. So the point is, prasad is not just a cultural commodity. It's a spiritual principle. Cultural commodity means, okay, in the culture that we may have been brought up in, generally we would have equated prasad with a particular item. Okay, this food is what is prasad. But actually, prasad is a spiritual principle. The spiritual principle is that whatever we eat, we offer to Krishna before that, and then take the remnants as His mercy. So, seen in this way, prasad should not be restricted to one small morsel that we get at the end of a religious function. All the food that we eat should be prasad. So, all the food that we eat should be prasad. Then prasad has to become a spiritual principle, because different people will eat different kinds of food. Now, certainly Krishna doesn't want the flesh of His own other children. So that's why we can't eat non-vegetarian food. We can't offer non-vegetarian food to Krishna. So non-vegetarian, we can't have non-vegetarian prasadam. But the different people have different cultures, and in their culture the cuisines are different, and accordingly foods are different. So if somebody is from a part of the country, part of the world where pizzas are very common, and the people there are habituated to eating pizzas, and then they offer pizzas and then take pizzas, so then that is perfectly all right, because that is the normal food. So what they are doing is the cultural translation of the spiritual principle will vary. The cultural translation or the cultural expression. So for us, prasadam may translate as sweet, or if we are devotees who have a culture of taking full meal as prasad, then it will be rice dal sabji chapati. Now that is prasad for us, so that's fine. Now the cultural translation of prasad will vary depending on time, place, circumstance. So pizza can also be prasad, because what is important is the spiritual principle. That the spiritual principle is that the food that we eat, we offer to Krishna and then we take that. But this doesn't necessarily mean that pizza prasad is necessarily a very desirable prasadam which everybody should be excited about. It's prasadam, no doubt. So we don't see prasadam in terms of material vision. This is goodness, passion, ignorance. Nor should we see prasadam, oh, this is an Indian item, this is a Chinese item, this is an Italian item. Now, for a functional, conversational point of view, they might hold, oh, today there is Italian. But internally, we should focus on the point that it is prasadam. So, although there is no rule against, say, Indian devotees taking Chinese food, Chinese prasadam, the point is that we need to remember Krishna. So if we get Chinese food, then even if it is Chinese prasadam, we are thinking more of Chinese than of prasadam. So in our consciousness, the focus is not Krishna, the focus is something else. So the same applies to, say, west, there we can have mantra rock. If you have Hare Krishna mantra rock, then sang with rock music. Now for those whom rock is familiar, that is the way they are spiritualizing their music. That is the way they are bringing Krishna into the music with which they are already familiar. And for them it is good. But for those who are not exposed to, say, rock music, now of course practically many people in India are exposed to rock music, but for those who are habituated to a traditional culture, for them to participate in mantra rock, all that is happening is that they will hardly be thinking about the mantra, they will be thinking more of rock. So each of us has to take a moral inventory, a devotional inventory of ourselves, and decide what are the things that I can do in which I can maintain my remembrance of Krishna. And of course, it's not that I have to give up all other activities. I may do those activities also, but then I have to be honest with myself. I shouldn't just spiritualize them, whitewash them, saying that, oh, this is all devotional. I can, if I feel, if my desire is very strong and the desire is not very, is not anti-devotional, then I can do those things. But I shouldn't think that that is the same as doing activities which help me to remember Krishna better. So I'm not saying that, say, paratha is a better prasad or higher prasadam item than and pizza. That's not the point here. The point is, I have to check individually what brings me greater remembrance of Krishna. So if I'm excited just because of the material nature of the item, then I'm not really in devotional consciousness. And I have to be honest about that. I cannot artificially say that everything is equal. So Srila Prabhupada, we see, even when he went to America, which are part of the world, he taught Americans not just the universal spiritual principles. He also taught them specific cultural practices. So he taught his Western disciples to run, to wear traditional dresses, to cook traditional cuisines, and to learn traditional songs. So Srila Prabhupada wanted very much for our traditional culture to be continued. Now, Srila Prabhupada wanted the Krishna consciousness movement, ISKCON, to act as a bridge which takes traditional Indian culture to the rest of the world. So now the challenge with the bridge is, it's very difficult to have, once a bridge is constructed, to allow only one-way traffic on the bridge. So there is two-way traffic. So what is happening is that the original intended traffic was that a traditional Indian culture should go through ISKCON to people all over the world. But what is happening also is that there is the other-way traffic. That means the culture from all over the world is coming through ISKCON to the traditional places in India. So devotees who may have never heard before they were introduced to ISKCON of chow mein or pizza, they start taking chow mein prasadam and pizza prasadam. Again, this is not bad, but we have to be aware of what is happening and whether what is happening is taking us towards Krishna or taking us away from Krishna. We have to be clear in our consciousness of what are the things that are anukul to our bhakti and what are pratikul to our bhakti, and do them accordingly. Now, going beyond this, we will discuss about the remaining sections in tomorrow's class, next class. Thank you. Hare Krishna.